content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue. This week, we will take a look at history. One of the articles is on activist Ida B. Wells, whose birthday was last Friday, July 17th. I had not learned about her until college, so I'm excited to share her story with you all while you're a bit younger. Also, Teen Vogue has an OG history series that I discovered recently, and Teen Vogue explains that the OG history is a Teen Vogue series where we unearth history not told through a white, cis, heteropatriarchal lens. So I will try to pick some articles from that series each week to share with you all, starting with this week's episode. But first, we will start with Remembering Ida B. Wells' Legacy, an educator, feminist, and anti-lynching civil rights leader. In this op-ed, author, speaker, and professor Michelle Duster explains the life and legacy of her great-grandmother, anti-lynching crusader Ida B. Wells. This was published September 20th, 2018. These days, my great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells, is referred to as a boss. She was an educator, a journalist, a feminist, a businesswoman, a newspaper owner, a public speaker, a suffragist, a civil rights activist, and a women's club leader. She was a founder of the NAACP, a founder of the National Association of Colored Women, a founder of the Alpha Suffrage Club, a founder of the Negro Fellowship League. She wrote, she spoke, she traveled, she challenged the racist and sexist norms of her time that often involved violence and terror. Although she endured enormous criticism and threats to her life, she never shut up. She never gave up. She fought for equality and justice for almost 50 years. This phenomenal woman was born a slave in Holly Springs, Mississippi on July 16th, 1862. And her 16-year-old, and she was 16 years old when she lost both of her parents and a younger brother in a yellow fever epidemic. She decided at that young age to take on the responsibility of taking care of her five remaining siblings and started her career as a teacher in rural Mississippi, then moved to Memphis, where she continued to teach. While teaching, she started her journalism career by writing for church newsletters. She wrote about social and political issues at the time and developed a following. While riding a train from work one day in 1884, while in her early 20s, she was asked to move from the ladies' car to the colored car, which doubled as the smoking car. She refused and was thrown off the train. Rather than cower to the powers that be, she wrote about the incident in the newspaper and sued the Chesapeake, Ohio, and Southwestern Railroad. She won the case and was awarded $500, though it was appealed all the way to the Tennessee Supreme Court. 2 years later, the ruling was overturned in favor of the railroad company on the grounds that Wells was harassing the company. While still teaching, she became co-owner of the Memphis Free Speech newspaper. She expressed her frustration with separate and unequal school systems and wrote about it, then lost her teaching job. She got busy traveling around Mississippi, selling subscriptions for the newspaper, and built up a following as a writer. My great-grandmother's life completely changed on March 9, 1892. Three of her enterprising friends, who owned a grocery store, which rivaled a white-owned store, were lynched. Ida B. Wells knew that her friends, Tom Moss, Calvin McDowell, and Will Stewart, were only guilty of being economic rivals to a white-owned business. The common narrative to justify lynching was that black men violated white women, but she recognized that lynching had nothing to do with crime. It was a tool used to keep the black community in an economic and socially inferior position. The murder of her friends set her off, and she exposed the truth about why her friends were lynched, urging black people in Memphis to boycott streetcars and white-owned businesses and to pack up their stuff and head to Oklahoma, which was a territory at the time. She wrote, "There is, therefore, only one thing left that we can do. Save our money and leave a town which will neither protect our lives and property nor give us a fair trial in the courts, but take us out and murder us in cold blood when accused by white persons." Even though the people from the streetcar company warned her to stop, she continued to lambast the white community. "Nobody in this section believes the old threadbare lie that Negro men rape white women. If Southern white men are not careful, they will overreach themselves and public sentiment will have a reaction. A conclusion will then be reached which will be very damaging to the moral reputation of their women," she wrote. Her implication that liaisons between white women and black men were consensual set off a fury. While she was out of town in Philadelphia, her printing press was destroyed, and she was threatened to be killed on sight. She lost everything she owned and never returned to Memphis. She went on to New York City, where she worked with T. Thomas Fortune on his newspaper, The New York Age. She wrote pamphlets about the reality of lynching and started speaking publicly about its horrors and was invited to England in 1893. She spoke about the atrocities while overseas, then went to Chicago to work on a pamphlet protesting the exclusion of African Americans from the 1893 World's Fair. She married prominent attorney Ferdinand L. Barnett in 1895 and did what few married women did at that time. She hyphenated her last name, becoming Ida B. Wells - Barnett. She and her husband had four children together. Their youngest daughter, Alfreda, is my grandmother. And Wells Barnett continued her work while juggling motherhood. She was involved in the suffrage movement, started the first kindergarten in Chicago for black children, worked to stop racial segregation of schools, and founded and managed the Negro Fellowship League, which provided housing and job assistance to black men who migrated to the city from the South. Wherever she saw injustice or inequality, she raised her voice and did what she could to effect change until her death at age 68 on March 25th, 1931. Ida B. Wells spent her life fighting for justice and equality. She truly believed that exposing injustice would lead to change. "The way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them," she said. "It's why I've been working with a committee since 2008 to develop a monument in honor of my great-grandmother, which will be located on the land where the Ida B. Wells homes once stood in Chicago." Between 2011 and the end of 2017, less than a third of the needed budget had been raised. But at the beginning of this year, I decided to make appeals to several organizations and go directly to the public via Twitter to gain support for the project. This resulted in over $200,000 in donations raised online within a six-month period. The goal is to have the completed work installed in 2019. Ida B. Wells did not allow herself to be marginalized or silenced. Even though she faced threats, lost property, and endured criticism, she felt what she had to say was important enough to say it. She refused to be silenced. She refused to make herself small. She stood up. She spoke out. And she made a difference for all of us. Okay, for our next article, "Nurses Have a History of Activism in the U.S., Championing Suffrage and Healthcare Access." So this article is by Alicia Puglionesi. I believe I'm pronouncing that right. Puglionesi. It was published July 14th, 2020, and it is a part of the Teen Vogue OG History series, where Teen Vogue unearths history not told through a white, cis-heteropatriarchal lens. This op-ed talks about how nurses in the U.S. have spent the past century fighting for economic justice, voting rights, and health care access. The people who provide the lion's share of medical care in America have little say in how our health system works. This has been undeniable during the coronavirus epidemic, which nurses protesting at the White House and outside of hospitals to demand basic protective gear. Beyond chaos and profiteering in the medical supply chain, these protests point to the failure of those in power to direct the nation's resource toward critical public needs. Officials have been slow to advocate for frontline heroes, with the federal government refusing to coordinate supply distribution and stalling on issues like hazard pay, and thousands fall ill on the job. In 1917, nurses joined protests in front of the White House gates for a different reason. They believed that if women won the right to vote, they could reform public health, set workplace standards, fund hospitals, and improve the lives of the working class and poor people who bore the greatest burden of sickness. Medical professionals often face pressure to appear neutral and stay out of politics, but nurses have long believed that sick bodies are political. Their profession formed in defiance of those who devalued care work as feminine and unskilled. For many nursing leaders, joining the movement for women's suffrage and going to jail with fellow protesters was part of their medical mission. The most visible face of the women's suffrage movement was a white middle class, I'm sorry, was a white middle and upper class, was white middle and upper class women who engaged in escalating protest as well as behind-the-scenes negotiations with political leaders throughout the 1910s. The history of their racist exclusion of black people is well known. Black suffragists, as historian Martha Jones details, organized their own movement within churches and women's clubs, such as the National Conference of Colored Women, and built a base of black voting power. Where suffrage intersects with nursing, there was a double exclusion, since black nurses also had to fight for recognition in their profession. White-led nursing organizations often enforced the racist frameworks of medicine and society, even in their efforts at improving public health. White nurses who became vocal suffragists were seen by their peers as radicals, but they accepted the color line as a fact of American life. Today's health workers face their own internal hierarchies, and in looking at past activism, it becomes clear that speaking out for themselves and their patients means challenging the intertwined oppression of race, gender, and class. In June of 1917, suffrage demonstrators made their first stand outside of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Among those arrested was 59-year-old Lavinia Dock. For three decades before, Dock had been a powerful force in the world of nursing, helping to found the International Council of Nurses and the American Nurses Association. Yet she passed up professional advancement to work at the Henry Street Settlement, a community center serving immigrants on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. There, she became involved not just in public health, but in struggles for better working and living conditions. Dock also noticed that the troubles within New York's factories were not so different from what nurses faced in hospitals: low pay, long hours, and hostile management. She began urging nurses to support trade unions in solidarity. Dock picketed the garment workers in the 1909 shirtwaist strike, considered to be the largest labor action by women up to that time. Another commonality, neither nurses nor garment workers could vote. Their livelihoods were terribly precarious, terribly uncertain, unstable, and insecure, Dock warned, unless protected well and firmly by legislation. The law didn't protect them because the government did not represent them. Doc became a militant voice in a new wave of suffrage activism that broke out in the 1910s. Suffrage groups were dominated by wealthy, white, educated women, and some leaders were not above bashing immigrants and African Americans when they thought it would win favor for their cause. Though Doc came from a wealthy family, she rejected this narrow strategy and built coalitions with labor and immigrant groups. She helped to organize suffrage parades in New York City that included working class Eastern European, Irish, Chinese, and Italian immigrants, culminating in a massive march up Fifth Avenue in 1913. This was only the beginning of a grueling crusade. Doc moved to Washington, D.C. to join the Council of the National Women's Party, which in 1917 made the unprecedented move of stationing picketers in front of the White House. Doc went straight to the picket line. "The young are at the gates," she declared, throwing in her lot with the radicals who were decades her junior. Their presence angered male onlookers and led to violent confrontations. When police cracked down on June 27th, she and six other protesters were sentenced to 3 days in jail. A few weeks later, she was arrested again and ordered to serve 25 days in the notorious Occoquan workhouse. Beyond these historic protests, Doc poured immense effort into persuading her fellow nurses to take a unified stand on suffrage. Nurses were already highly organized, with national, state, and local groups pushing their professional goals. Many nurses feared that if they spoke out on suffrage, the men who controlled their workplaces would retaliate. Doc encountered that there was only one way to take charge of their own profession. "Until we possess the ballot," she told American Nurse Association, "we may get up in the morning to find that all we had gained has been taken from us." Her full court press in every imaginable nursing magazine, plus a relentless schedule of speeches, led the American Nurses Association, or the ANA, to change its position on suffrage. In 1908, members had voted to stay neutral, though opponents objected to noisy, undignified political agitation. By 1912, Doc and other agitators turned the tide. A suffrage resolution passed, urging nurses across the United States to demand equal and unabridged political powers for women. The ANA sent a delegation to march in the landmark suffrage parade in Washington, D.C. in 1913, wearing their uniforms and the moral authority of their profession. Organizers notoriously attempted to segregate this parade, leading to confrontations with Ida B. Wells and other black attendees, many of whom defied orders and marched with their delegations. And of course, you all know who Ida B. Wells is now. Two black doctors and one trained nurse, whose name could not be ascertained, marched. Having crossed the threshold into public protest, many nurses channeled their frustration with the miserable state of American healthcare into an aggressive push for the vote. "There was a time when I did not feel any particular interest in women's suffrage," Sarah Tarleton Colvin reflected in a memoir written at the end of her life. Like Doc, Colvin went into nursing in the 1890s to gain independence and a sense of purpose. Yet as soon as she set foot in the hospital, she saw that she had not escaped the power dynamics of women's work. Nursing students were used as free labor. The absolute need for these unpaid, intelligent workers was built into the very fabric of hospital management, she observed. After graduating from Johns Hopkins in 1892, Colvin worked in operating rooms and as a public health nurse in Baltimore, visiting the homes of people too poor to see a doctor. She married in 1897 and bowed to social conventions that barred middle-class wives from pursuing paid work. Instead, she took the lead in pushing legal reforms as the unpaid president of the Minnesota Nurses Association, where she became increasingly frustrated with the deep indifference of male politicians toward public health. The United States' entry into World War I added a bitter irony to suffrage protests. President Woodrow Wilson proclaimed in 1917 that the world must be made safe for democracy and for the right of those who submit to authority to have a voice in their own governments. The war became a crucial wedge in the suffrage struggle. More than 22,000 nurses mobilized by the American Red Cross served in the U.S. Army. As one cartoonist put it, "If you're good enough for war, you're good enough to vote." In a nation seized by militarism, photographs of nurses in gas masks seem to prove the value of women as citizens. Colvin embodied these contradictions. She was opposed to the war, but nevertheless volunteered as a Red Cross nurse in Baltimore, where her physician husband was serving in the Army Medical Corps at Fort McHenry. One day in early January 1919, Colvin told her husband she was visiting friends and left Fort McHenry on an early morning train to go to Washington. "My plan was to go immediately on the picket line." The National Woman's Party had escalated its protest by lighting bonfires in front of the White House and was again met with aggression from an anti-suffrage crowd. Colvin went to jail twice that winter, serving 5-day sentences. She joined fellow suffragists in a hunger strike and left barely able to walk. Civil disobedience and jail time were not merely a stunt. Suffragists endured beatings and force feedings, which scandalized respectable society. In a way, their point was that an upper-class woman and wartime nurse like Colvin did not belong behind bars for wanting the same rights as men. Colvin, however, drew a broader conclusion. In her view, no one belonged behind bars. "A criminal is really a sick person who is receiving the wrong diagnosis," she wrote, "and prisons would never cure inequality." Colvin, like Doc, believed that suffrage fell short by focusing on middle and upper class women. Even after the passage of the 19th Amendment, there was no real freedom without economic rights. To Colvin, suffrage was only a tool with which to work, and that tool required a mass politics of fair wages, affordable housing, and universal public health care. "Under our economic system of free enterprise," she wrote, "adequate medical services can never be paid for as a private cost." Although Colvin and Doc envisioned feminism for an international workers' movement, neither they nor mainstream white feminists were willing to confront their own racism to make common cause with African Americans. Doc spoke out against unethical prejudice in nursing, but black nursing leaders such as Ada Toms had to devote their careers to fighting discriminatory training, hiring, and pay. Black activists like Ida B. Wells and W.E.B. Du Bois were excluded from white-run suffrage organizations. The black fight for the vote continued through the civil rights era and continues today. The repercussions are still with us. It's impossible to know what a century-long inclusive women's struggle could have accomplished. Historians still debate the impact of radical pickets, bonfires, and arrests compared with the behind-the-scenes lobbying of moderate suffrage leaders. When Woodrow Wilson urged the U.S. Senate to support the 19th Amendment in September of 1918, he insisted that "the voices of foolish and intemperate agitators do not reach me at all." Instead, the amendment was a strategic move vital to the winning of the war. The vote would reward women for their patriotic suffering and sacrifice and toil. Even many suffragists embraced his wartime justification, agreeing that citizenship must be earned, pointing to heroic images of Red Cross nurses and mothers of soldiers. Though patriotism was an effective tactic, It sounds a lot like today's praise for nurses as healthcare heroes battling COVID-19. Rather than centering their needs and demands, it emphasizes their selfless service to the state and the market, which have no functional plan to control the pandemic. Despite their technical expertise, and despite the fact that many nurses are no longer female-identifying people, nursing remains a form of feminized care work. Precisely because the healthcare industry is so dependent on their labor, it must claim that labor as an entitlement, a natural function that nurses should be proud to carry out. As historian Susan Reverby puts it, they are ordered to care by a system that will not stop causing harm. This year marks the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which Americans will celebrate as a landmark victory for women. But the right to vote was not the end goal for many suffragist nurses. They made demands for public health investment, economic justice, and universal health care that are still unfulfilled. Recognizing the need for racial equality, activist nurses joined the Medical Committee for Human Rights in the 1960s to treat those brutalized during Southern voter registration drives. Today, as mass protests against racial oppression erupt in the midst of a pandemic, Americans face a disconnect. The right to vote has not secured other basic rights to human welfare. The fact that nurses are once again on the march, this time fighting not for the vote, but for their lives and those of their patients, suggests that we've reached the limits of last century's reform. So I only have about a minute left, so I wanted to describe the photo that accompanied this article. It is a picture of what looks to be a suffragist protest parade with lines of women nurses marching. They're holding flags. There's a sign that says nurses. They're all organized. They have sashes on that appear to state something about voting. So I think votes for women. I think that's what the sash should say. So they're obviously suffragist nurses voting, protesting in a parade for the right to vote. And as indicated as in the article, it does show that all of the women in this photo appear to be white, and there do not appear to be any of any black women in the photo. So it is interesting what could have been if the century-long struggle for women's rights would have been more inclusive. But I think it's a still very interesting part of our history. Well, that brings us to the end of today's program. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.